his arms and legs broken before they dropped him to the bottom of the pit. To this day, I can still hear their pitiful screams. It was a living hell. The mine was run as a major strategic facility by Politburo members dispatched from Party Central and policed by the army with maximum security. The top man was said to be from Stalin's own hometown, a cold, hard party functionary, still young and full of ambition. His only concern was to raise production figures. The consumption of laborers was a matter of indifference to him. As long as the production figures went up, Party Central would recognize his mine as exemplary and reward him with an expanded labor force. No matter how many workers died, they would always be replaced. To keep the figures rising, he would authorize the digging of veins that, under ordinary circumstances, would have been considered too dangerous to work. Naturally, the number of accidents continued to rise as well. But he didn't care about that. The director was not the only cold-hearted individual supervising the mine. Most of the guards inside the mine were former convicts, uneducated men of shocking cruelty and vindictiveness. They displayed no sign of sympathy or affection, as if living out here at the edge of the earth, they had been transformed over the years by the frigid Siberian air into subhuman creatures. They had committed crimes and been sent to Siberian prisons, but now that they had served their long sentences, they no longer had homes or families to go back to. They had taken local wives and children with them and settled into the Siberian soil. Japanese prisoners of war were not the only ones sent to work in the mine. There were many Russian criminals as well, political prisoners and former military officers who were victims of Stalin's purges. Not a few of these men were well-educated, refined individuals. Among the Russians were very few women and children, probably the scattered remains of political prisoners' families. They would be put to work collecting rubbish, washing clothes, and other such tasks. Young women were often used as prostitutes. Besides the Russians, the trains would bring Poles, Hungarians, and other foreigners, some with dusky skins, Armenians and Kurds, I should imagine. The camp was partitioned into three living areas, the largest one where Japanese prisoners of war were kept together, the area for criminals and other prisoners of war, and the area for non-criminals. In this last, there lived regular miners and mining professionals, officers, and guards of the military guard detachment, some with families and ordinary Russian citizens. There was also a large army post near the station. Prisoners of war and other prisoners were forbidden to leave their assigned areas. The areas were divided from each other by massive barbed wire fences, patrolled by soldiers carrying machine guns. As a translator with liaison duties, I had to visit headquarters each day and was free to move from area to area as long as I showed my pass. Near headquarters was the railway station, and a kind of one-street town with a few shabby stores, a bar, and an inn for officials and high-ranking officers on inspection tours. The square was lined with horse troughs, and a big red flag of the USSR flew from a flagpole in the center. Beneath the flag was parked an armored vehicle with a machine gun against which there was always leaning a bored-looking young soldier in full military gear. The newly built military hospital was situated at the far end of the square, with a large statue of Joseph Stalin at its entrance. There is a man I must tell you about now. I encountered him in the spring of 1947, probably around the beginning of May, when the snow had finally melted. A year and a half had already passed since I was sent to the mine. When I first saw him,